Good afternoon and welcome to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg and we're live for an hour each weekday afternoon at this time. We have open phone lines for you if you have questions about the Bible or about Christianity and we'd like to bring those up for conversation. We'll be glad to talk to you about those. And I just want to say this too, that there are certain people who call a lot and I've had some requests sent to me that we give priority to people who don't call as frequently, and just want to make sure, because sometimes the lines are all full, and if they're full with people who call several times a week or something, then that often bounces new callers off. And so I do want to give preference to people who don't call all the time. I would even recommend for callers who are in the habit of calling very frequently that you maybe call once or twice a week at the most and leave it for others to get through. Right now, we do have lines open, and you can get through right now if you call 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. And as I said, there are lines open right now, so you can call right through if you call now. Our first caller is Justine from Mesa. It says Mesa, Texas. Is that right?
Arizona.
I thought it'd be Mesa, Arizona. Yeah, the call screen I thought it was in Texas. But go ahead. Good to hear from you. Yeah. By the way, is this a Justine that I met this weekend?
Yes. Yes, it is.
Good to hear from you.
I want to thank you so much for coming to Phoenix this past weekend. It was just a real pleasure to get to meet you and Dana and hear you speak in person and bring my kids. And it was just really great. I was thinking today about the message you gave last night on disappointment with God and how if we feel disappointed, we need to examine what our expectations were. And I was thinking how there's so many choices in life that God gives us freedom in, everything from where we go to school, whom we marry, where we live, where we work, friendships, all of that and more. There's a real overlap in the things God does directly in our lives and the things we, in our limited knowledge, choose for ourselves. So my question is, what about when a believer becomes disappointed with their own choices in an area? Do they just lean on Romans 8:28, keep moving forward? Where does a person land in their thinking on that? And yeah, I can take my answer off the air.
Okay, I appreciate your call. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you.
And it was good meeting you too and your children. Okay, so we were talking last night, and by the way, the lectures I gave in Arizona are all posted videos at our Facebook page. The Facebook page is Steve Gregg, The Narrow Path. And if you look that up, you'll see, if you scroll down, you should be able to find, well, not all of them, only about five of the lectures I gave, I think, are actually there. I gave seven lectures in 3 days, but anyway, the last one I gave was called Disappointment with God. And Justine was asking, well, what if it's not really God that's disappointed you? What if you've disappointed yourself as a Christian? You know you've made some mistakes that God didn't necessarily have anything to do with. Or to say, I wouldn't say he had nothing to do with them, because I think he has something to do with our lives, no matter what we do. But he is paying attention. For example, the hairs of your head are numbered, Jesus said. So we know God's paying attention to everything. And if not a sparrow falls to the ground apart from his will, certainly we're worth more than many sparrows. So even when we're making mistakes, God is aware of it. And God is capable of preventing us from making certain mistakes. Even though we have free will, he can communicate with us very strongly if he wants to. And he won't make us do something, but he can let us know we're going the wrong way. I think Christians often have made mistakes when they weren't seeking the will of God, and God has allowed them to make those mistakes because they can learn from them. And sometimes it's a very costly lesson. For example, you mentioned marrying. If you marry the wrong person, and that person never gets saved, let us say, or it never gets any better, that's a very costly lesson, to be sure. But there are valuable lessons. Costly lessons are valuable. Things that cost a lot usually have some value, and there are many valuable lessons to learn from those mistakes. And you might not even get, if somebody makes that mistake and marries the wrong person, they may never get out of that marriage in their lifetime. They might, because that person might leave or die or something else could happen. They may have another chance, but many people do not. Many people make a mistake, and they're in that mistake for the rest of their lives. And it is disappointing to think, well, I wish I had been wiser. I wish I had taken counsel more. I wish I'd been seeking the will of God more. I wish God had warned me about this. But he didn't. So what am I going to learn from it now is really the approach we have to take. So I have to learn how to serve God in a certainly less than ideal situation. And it may not be marriage. It may be a job. It may be that you quit a job to seek another career. And the career you sought, you know, washed out, and the job you left behind is gone, and it was a good one. And, you know, people make mistakes all the time. And no doubt there's often occasion to be kicking ourselves for things we've done. But once we've done it, we know that God could have, I mean, he would have had to perhaps act exceptionally in the case, but he could, if he really wanted to, he could have stepped in to prevent that from happening. You know, God, there's a lot of things God can do without violating your free will to prevent something from happening that you want to happen, or to let you know that it's the wrong way to go. And the fact that God allows you to make mistakes, despite the fact that he loves you and has a plan for your life, means that he is flexible enough that if you do the wrong thing, he still can have a plan for that. And you can learn the lessons of not so much, I mean, it's not always so much learning the lesson that, well, I won't make that mistake again, because sometimes you won't even have the opportunity to make that mistake again. But there are other lessons to learn. Lessons to learn that are learned by applying the teachings of Jesus and the Christian obligations in situations that are difficult, that even involve suffering, that where we learn to love difficult people or to live under difficult circumstances with less money. We have more things. We learn to trust God in ways that we might not have had things gone better. God does work all things together for the good of those who love him and who are the called according to his purpose. So, you know, that is a different, something of a different angle than disappointment with God, although there are people who will blame God for it. You know, they'll make their own mistakes, not doing what God told them to do, and they'll be angry at God about it. There's kids like that who are angry at their parents because the kids didn't take their parents' advice. The parents raised them to be Christians, and they gave up their Christian faith, went off and did horrible things, ruined their whole life, and now they're angry at their parents, even though their, you know, the problem is their own. We do have to own our own mistakes. We can't blame God for the mistakes we make, but we can be sure that God hasn't disowned us because of them, and that, you know, the purpose of God is not thwarted by our mistakes. Maybe some things could have been better, but God can redeem even very, very bad lives gone very badly wrong. And the Bible has got testimonies to that. Of course, we hear Christian testimonies all the time of people whom God has redeemed a situation where they've, you know, they've made serious mistakes and possibly lost permanently certain opportunities through their errors. But God still can take that and make it into something of value. But that's not an argument for being careless about making right choices. Because obviously making the right choices and being in the perfect position that God had in mind for you, if you'd been wise or whatever, no doubt would have been better still. But life can be very good in Christ, even in hard situations, as some of which we know we caused. And hopefully we become wiser in the sense that we might not make the same mistake, or even if we're not in the position to make it, we can counsel other people who are in the danger of making the same mistakes. A lot of times our mistakes become the basis of credibility when we counsel other people. And we say, hey, I made the mistake you were just about to make, and look what happened to me. So, I mean, those are just some thoughts on your question. There's not just an easy three-step answer that I know of to that question, but I would just say those are the ways I would respond to those circumstances that you described. I appreciate your call, and I thank you for joining us today. Let's talk to Hugh from Spokane, Washington. Hugh, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, how are you today?
I'm well, thanks.
Good. Last week I was listening to the show, I believe it was last week or the week before, and a gentleman had asked about the racial divide in this country.
Yes.
Uh-huh. And in your reply, you said that it was former President Barack Obama who really contributed to the racial divide. And I'm wondering.
No, I didn't say that. I said the racial divide did become worse, not better, during the years that he was president. But it has become worse during the years that Trump has been president, too. It's just been getting worse. I don't think it's Obama's fault. I don't think it's Trump's fault. I think it's the fault of certain social factors. But I don't think they're coming from the right, and I don't think they're coming from Christianity. The person was asking me really about racism in the church. That was their question. But we did talk about racism in society and how it's gotten worse, too. But go ahead.
Well, and I just respectfully disagree with you because you said right on the radio, you said he made it worse. He made it worse. And you know, in whether or not we disagree with President Obama's politics, I mean, he was such an honorable man, barely a scandal, married to the same wife his whole life, two beautiful children, reached out to many people across many divides. And I just wonder, you know.
You want to know someone who's even a more wonderful man, but was even a worse president? Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter's a wonderful man. He's a very generous man. He's in his 90s, and he's still serving people, Habitat for Humanity. You know, he serves his church. I'm sure he's a wonderful man, but he was not good for the country. In my opinion, and I don't think I said what you said I said, because I would not generally say something quite so political on the air. I do sometimes speak about things. I did say, and I do believe, that the racial divide in this country has intensified in the past more than a decade. And you know, many people thought that by electing a black president, that would kind of heal it. And it didn't have that effect. Now, I don't have any particular policies of Barack Obama that I would lay at his door and say he increased racism in this country by that. I do think that he tended to, I think he did tend to support the idea of identity politics more than some do. And I don't think that's helpful for the racial divide. But I'm not, you know, it's not my purpose on this program to be taking up a complaint about one president or another. I think every president we have had has had his faults and some have had virtues, but that's not that's not my primary concern on this program. But I want to go back and listen to that program and see if I said anything like what you just said I said, because I don't think I would. Yeah.
Well, and first of all, I appreciate your clarification. And mm-hmm. if I misheard, you have my apologies 70 times sevenfold.
That's all right.
But yeah, right. So anyway, thank you very much for clarifying. And because I think you're right, we as Christians are called to always be compassionate, to, you know, to call people to respect and understanding. And like Jesus said, if we are to be a servant to all. And so thank you very much for taking your time to listen to me respectfully and to answer me respectfully. And I hope you and your family have a lovely day. Thank you very much.
Well, same to you. Thank you, Hugh, for calling. God bless.
Okay. Bye-bye.
Bye now. All right. Our next caller is Cindy from Kingston, Washington. Cindy, welcome to The Narrow Path.
Hi, Steve. I wanted to ask, I'm not sure if I was listening to an archive or a current one, but a man called that was in China a lot, and he was concerned about meat being sacrificed, and he described it as they placed the meat before an idol. I don't know if it was Buddha. I really don't know what idol it was.
Uh-huh.
But and you spoke about that, and it was something that I've never known. What did it look like in New Testament era that Paul described as sacrificing animals, if you didn't know? Was it the same thing, placing something before an idol and letting it sit there for a period of time?
Well, at least part of the animal. What they did, and this is actually the same practice that was practiced at the Jewish temple, that when people would bring an animal to sacrifice to God, part of the animal, generally speaking, was eaten by the priests. Part of it was eaten by the worshipers, and the rest was burned on the altar. Now, in some cases, only a few parts of the animal were burned on the altar. In certain cases, with the whole burnt offerings, the entire animal, after being skinned, was burned on the altar. But there were different kinds of sacrifices, and a great number of them involved the offering up of part of an animal, and there were then remnants of the meat that were part of the same animal. The animal had been sacrificed to a god. If in Jerusalem, it would be to Yahweh, but in pagan lands, they would sacrifice to pagan gods. And with the extra meat, they would have public feasts. And these public feasts were open to anybody to come, and they were great social gatherings. And the meat was generally served, the feasts were held in honor of the idols, so that that portion of the animal that had not been burned on an altar to the idol would still be offered in a feast in honor of the idol, and people would eat it as a public thing. Now, some of the meat, if it didn't all get, I mean, lots of times there are hundreds of animals sacrificed, so if it didn't all get eaten that way, they would just sell it to the meat sellers in the marketplace. So in a pagan land, if you go into the meat market, there's meat for sale, and some of it is the remnants of animals that were sacrificed in these pagan temples, and some of it would not be. And, you know, the Corinthians, for example, lived in a very idolatrous city. And some of the Christians in Corinth were wondering, is it safe for us to buy meat in the marketplace? Is it safe to eat meat sacrificed to idols? And Paul's response was, well, you don't want to go into those festivals. You don't want to go into those idol feasts. You know, that's definitely compromising. You don't want to do anything to honor the idols. But he said, if you buy meat in the marketplace, don't worry about where it came from. He said, there's nothing magic. There's no magical curse on the meat or anything like that. It's just meat. It's just meat. And the belly's made for meat. The meat's made for the belly. And it's no big thing, he said. He said, if you are invited to eat at someone's house and they tell you that the meat they're serving was sacrificed to an idol, he assumed that they're telling you that because they know you're a Christian and they think you probably would have qualms about it and or should. And he said, well, if that's the case, then don't partake. Because then your host is going to be stumbled because they think, as a Christian, you shouldn't eat it, and you don't want to, you know, stumble them about that. So Paul's giving he's kind of fine-tuning a command that was made at the Jerusalem Council and inserted into this letter that James and the Jerusalem Council had delivered by Paul and Barnabas to the Gentile churches. And one of the things they were saying, well, the main thing they were saying is you don't have to keep the Jewish law. You don't have to be circumcised. You don't have to become Jewish. You don't have to do anything except we're asking you to abstain from a few things, which Gentiles often do and which offend the Jews, and we'd like you to not do them. And one of them is to not eat meat sacrificed to idols. So the Jerusalem Council asked that Gentile Christians not eat meat sacrificed to idols. And the Corinthians were not real sure, well, what if we're invited to somebody's house? How do we know if the meat's been sacrificed to idols? Or what if we buy meat in the marketplace? How do we know if we're breaking this command? And Paul was saying, well, if you don't know that it is, it's not going to hurt you. If someone informs you that it is, then they think it's important. And if it's important to them, then it should be important enough to you not to stumble them, and you don't do it. And he said, and you certainly don't want to deliberately go into the idol feasts and eat the meat there. So Paul's simply taking this obligation that was placed on all the Gentile Christians at the Jerusalem Council and putting a finer point on it in, you know, here's how it applies in this situation. But in this situation, you don't have to worry about it because, frankly, you can't always know. And it's not as if an animal that was sacrificed to a demon now has demons attached to the meat when it's sold in the meat market. Paul said, that's superstition. Don't worry about that. We all know that's nothing at all. And so, that's what's going on.
Oh, excuse me.
Go ahead.
Excuse me. So today, in China, are they doing the temple part? I mean, are they doing the sacrifice, and it's being those things that you just spoke of being applied, or are they simply in a meat market butchering something, and then for their particular belief system,
I don't know the answer because I have not been to China. China is one of the places I've not been to, and I don't know what the practices are there. But I would assume that the idolatry in China and the sacrifice of animals in China, you know, would have some of the same kinds of practices would apply, and therefore the same principles would apply if you happen to be a Christian in China and, you know, buying meat or, you know, invited to homes or whatever.
Well, thank you very much. I appreciate that. Thank you.
Okay, Cindy, thanks for your call. God bless you. All right, our next caller is Joel from Temecula. Joel, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hey, no problem. Thank you for taking my call.
Uh-huh.
Hey, so I'm kind of in a spot right now where I don't have an answer because I've been caught up with trying to support a family of five, and, you know, I started off strong in my Bible and, you know, led my wife into, you know, her being a strong believer. We've been married for 20 years, but, you know, life takes over, and before you know it, you're just trying to pay the next bill, and I get on the radio, I listen to you, and found you on the radio. I'm really happy there's someone with a sound mind out there and some good, solid advice in a Christian walk. But I have a question of, when it comes to perfection, you know, my wife, she gets to stay home. She homeschools the kids, and she just stays in the Bible. She doesn't really want to hear from too many preachers and men. She just wants to say, you know, I want to have the Holy Spirit lead me. And I honor that. I respect that. I feel she's fortunate that she has the time to be able to just sit in the Word.
Sure, sure.
But over time, you know, some stuff has become very literal in her mind. And, you know, the one thing that's just very little, which I have teenage kids now, that of course their top out is nobody's perfect. And, you know, when it comes down to them getting in trouble, and, you know, I think that's true. Hopefully that's true. But now I've got a wife that's stuck on some verses that are just about perfection. I'm sure you know them all.
Right. And how is she applying them in a way that makes you uncomfortable?
Just, you know, basically to the point of there is a way to live without sin, go daily without ever sinning.
Mm-hmm. And how is this, you know, how is this creating friction in your home, either between you and her or her and the children, or what?
Well, I guess I want to know if I'm incorrect in saying that, you know, we're perfect through Christ. And, you know, my kids, of course, are confused, and there's a way we feel like we're at this point where we feel we're hopeless. It's a hopeless situation. And when somebody, I want to support everything she's saying to my children, of course, thank God I have a wife that is homeschooling.
Okay, well, let me jump in here. I mean, it's good that your wife wants to be perfect, and there are certainly verses in the Bible that she probably is using. Not least would be the last verse in Matthew chapter 5, where Jesus said, be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect, or perhaps Hebrews chapter 6, where it says, let us go on to perfection. Of course, it also says in Colossians that you are complete in him, which is not the same word. The word in the Bible that's translated perfect is a Greek word that can mean complete, it can mean mature, it can mean perfect. And in the passage, each passage, you have to ask yourself, which English word is this really best represented by? For example, in Hebrews 6, when it says, let us go on to perfection, that's in the King James Version. Every modern translation will say, let us go on to maturity, because he's just been complaining that his readers are immature. They only can have milk. They can't eat solid food because they're babes and so forth. He says, let's go on to maturity. The word perfection, the Greek word is the same one for maturity or for perfection, but he's obviously talking about maturity. It's not quite the same thing as being absolutely sinless, although being sinless is a great goal. When Jesus said, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, that's in a context where he's saying you don't want to be, doling out your love and your kindness to only a few people who are nice to you. You want to do this to everybody. You want to be complete and comprehensive in your love for all people. He says, be like your Father in heaven. He causes the rain to come on the evil and on the good, and causes the sun to shine on the just and the unjust. And if you only say hello to your friends and love your friends, even the tax collectors do that. No, you need to be like your Father in heaven, complete. Now, what he means by that is comprehensive in your love. And we have the same sermon, basically, in Luke chapter 6. And when he comes to that very point in the sermon, in Luke 6:36, instead of saying, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, he says, be merciful just as your Father also is merciful. In other words, your Father is merciful. He's not only kind to his friends, he's merciful and kind toward people who are his enemies. And that's the point Jesus is making. He makes it there leading up to that last verse in Matthew 5 and leading up to this verse in Luke 6. It's the same sermon. It's the same point. It's just that where Luke has Jesus saying, be merciful as your Father is merciful, Matthew renders it, be complete or comprehensive in your mercy and your love as your Father is. It's not talking about a sinless perfection. I will say, well, I'll tell you what, can you hold on through the break?
Yeah.
Okay, because I don't want to cut you loose here, because it sounds like there's something going on, you know, that we need to bring as much clarity to as we can.
Okay.
I'll put you on hold here, and I'll bring you right back after the break we have at the bottom of the hour here. Joel from Temecula. You're listening to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. We have another half hour ahead. We're not going away, so don't you go away if you don't have to. We do want you to know that the Narrow Path is listener-supported. And if you want to help us stay on the air, you can write to us at The Narrow Path, P.O. Box 1730, Temecula, California, 92593. Or you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, under the Donate tab. I'll be back in 30 seconds. Don't go away.
The book of Hebrews tells us, do not forget to do good and to share with others. So let's all do good and share The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg with family and friends. When the show is over today, tell one and all to go to thenarrowpath.com, where they can study, learn, and enjoy with free topical audio teachings, blog articles, verse-by-verse teachings, and archives of all The Narrow Path radio shows. And be sure to tell them to tune into the show right here on the radio. Share listener-supported The Narrow Path with Steve Gregg. Share and do good.
Welcome back to the Narrow Path radio broadcast. My name is Steve Gregg, and we are live for another half hour taking your calls. If you have questions about the Bible, or if you have a different way of looking at things, maybe you have a different viewpoint from the host, be glad to talk to you about that. Feel free to call. The number is 844-484-5737. That's 844-484-5737. Now, before the break, we were talking to Joel from Temecula, California, who was saying that there's a bit of a disagreement arisen between himself and his wife. She's a godly woman, a homeschooling mom. He's a godly father. But there's some disagreement in that she has taken a very, as you put it, very literal approach to some verses in the scripture about Christian perfection. And so she's saying that a Christian can be perfect and never sin. Now, I was saying before the break that the verses that people usually use for that are often, I think, poorly understood in the context they're given. The word perfection can mean mature, and that is certainly what it means in the context of Hebrews 6, where it says, let us go on to maturity, or go on to perfection, in the King James. And it also, and more commonly, frankly, can mean complete or comprehensive. And when Jesus is talking in Matthew 5, and at the end of chapter 5, the King James says, Jesus says, be perfect, even as your Father in heaven is perfect. Well, he doesn't mean in all respects, but he means in the respect that he's describing. He means complete. And what he's just done, he's addressed the issue of loving not only your friends, but loving your enemies too. He points out your Father loves his enemies, and you need to be like him. Be complete in your love is what he means. And the fact that he means that is made indisputable by looking at the parallel passage in Luke 6:36, where in the very same spot, in the very same sermon, instead of be perfect or be complete as your Father in heaven is, he says, be merciful as your Father in heaven is. That's the meaning of the statement in both passages, that you need to be merciful to people who aren't your friends, and love your enemies, and just like your Father in heaven does. Now, if your wife wants to be very literal, then when Jesus said, be perfect as your Father in heaven is perfect, there's no reason in the world to assume that this means sinless, although God is sinless, but God's perfect in knowledge. God's perfect in power. God is omnipresent. God is omniscient. You know, we can't be that. Certainly, to be perfect in every way that God is perfect is not one of the things that are available to us, nor what Jesus is recommending. Jesus, if we take a verse that sounds, you know, challenging to us in a certain case, and we don't look at the context, we can certainly become legalistic and even harsh with other people, when in fact, of course, that verse is trying to say the opposite thing. You need to be like God, merciful. But, you know, on the other hand, she has a point where Paul says in 1 Corinthians 10 that there is no temptation taking you but such as is common to man. And God is able, and he's faithful and is able to give you a way of escape from the temptation so that you might not succumb to it and might be able to bear it, he says. Now, that would be saying that anytime I'm tempted to sin, there is the option that God gives me of not sinning. In other words, I don't have, as a Christian, I'm not required to sin. I'm not doomed to sin. I sin because I don't avail myself of the opportunities God gives me to not do so. And now, that would mean if God gives me, every time I'm tempted, if God gives me a bona fide way of escape so I don't have to succumb to the temptation, then it would seem that mean I could live my whole life without ever sinning. I just have to make sure I take that way of escape every time I'm tempted, and I'll never succumb to temptation, so I'd live a sinless life. The problem with that is that none of us are really, I don't know what we should say, virtuous enough at heart and probably smart enough to see in advance those exits from the roads that lead to sin. A lot of times we're just not paying attention, and suddenly we're in a place of temptation that we were caught by surprise, perhaps. And if we were more observant, we would have seen, oh, there's a way of escape over there. If I hadn't gone this way, and I probably should have known not to go this way, I wouldn't have run into this, but I wasn't thinking. I wasn't careful. And frankly, it may be that I wasn't willing enough to avoid the temptation. There's something in us, it's our flesh, that kind of responds favorably to temptation. That is, there's certain things our flesh wants that are not the right things, and those are the very things where the temptations hit us. Now, we don't have to succumb to temptation. Paul said if we walk in the Spirit, we will not fulfill the lust of the flesh. He said that in Galatians 5:16. And so if we walk in the Spirit, which is certainly an option, and in fact a command, but if we do that, we will not be succumbing to the weaknesses and the desires of the flesh, and we will not be sinning when we are walking in the Spirit. But again, the hang-up is we don't walk in the Spirit all the time. And I don't know that anyone does all the time. I think that this is what the Christian life and Christian maturing process involves, is learning to walk in the Spirit, learning to stop, being distracted by the things of the world and the flesh and so forth. That's just it's a conditioning. It's a growth. It's a maturing. Peter tells us in 2 Peter 3:18, we need to grow in grace and in the knowledge of our Lord and Savior Jesus Christ. Well, when you grow in grace and when you grow in the knowledge of God, you will be more consistent in walking in the Spirit, and you will be more consistent in not fulfilling the lust of the flesh. But for someone to say, well, now that I'm a Christian, I can just stop sinning. Well, theoretically, okay, yeah, if you just never succumb to any temptation. But the problem is, no, I just don't know anybody who is so completely well-intentioned and so completely oblivious to the concerns of the flesh and so always walking in the Spirit that they never sin at all. But I will say this. I grew up being taught in the church I was raised in that it's inevitable that we will sin many times in thought, word, and deed every day. I mean, the church I grew up in apparently didn't have any concept of being sanctified or growing and becoming more like Christ, although that's the norm. Paul said that we behold as in a glass the glory of the Lord. We're being changed from glory to glory into the image of Christ. Well, that's going to look like something. We're not going to be sinning as much if we're more like Christ this year than we were last year. It is a lifetime growth experience, though. And so, you know, there's the need to be patient with, you know, with failure, but not patient in the sense that we say, ah, well, nobody's perfect, so it's okay if I'm not perfect. As a Christian, I never will say it's okay if I'm imperfect. I will say it's about average if I'm not perfect, but that's not okay. Like Paul said in Philippians chapter 3, and this might be a very good one for your wife to consider too. Paul said, I'm not perfect yet. Okay. Now, Paul was a very mature Christian when he said this. It's not like he was a baby Christian or a carnal Christian. He was a mature, strong Christian, and even referred to himself in those terms. He said in Philippians 3:12, not that I've already attained or am already perfected, but I press on that I may lay hold of that for which Christ Jesus has also laid a hold of me. Brethren, I do not count myself to have apprehended it. But one thing I do, forgetting the things which are behind, reaching forward for those that are ahead, I press toward the goal for the prize of the upward call of God in Christ Jesus. And then it says, therefore, let as many of us as are perfect think this way. But the word perfect there means mature. He has the word perfect twice in the passage. He says in verse 12, I'm not already perfect. And then he includes himself among those who are perfect. But it's obvious in the context that verse 12, perfect in verse 12 means I'm not completely perfected. But in verse 16 or verse 15, what he's saying is I am among those who are mature. The word perfect, same Greek word, can mean mature. The point he's making, though, is that he's not perfected. There are things about him that are not entirely Christ-like. But he says, that's not okay with me. You see, this is what we have to understand. When people say, well, nobody's perfect, they're making a statement that's really true, except for Jesus, nobody is perfect. But the fact that it's true, unfortunately, is sometimes applied to, therefore, it's okay if I'm not perfect. No, that's not the right way to think about it. It's not okay not to be perfect. It's just about average. The average is too low. We need to press on toward perfection. We need to press on toward the mark. In other words, we can't lower the bar and assume that something less than perfection is where we're willing to settle or what we're willing to settle for. We want to be just like Jesus. And if we stop that, if we stop pressing on toward that mark, well, we'll stagnate. And we, in fact, we'll lose ground. We'll not only cease to gain ground, we'll lose ground. So I think your wife needs to get a more holistic understanding of what the Bible means by perfection. Sometimes it merely means mature. Sometimes it means complete. Sometimes it really does mean sinless. But in the places where it speaks that way, Paul says, I'm not there yet. And if he's not there yet, it must not be something that most Christians are, because actually, I suspect that there were very few Christians on the planet who were more perfect than Paul when he was in his later years in life, you know, which is when he wrote this. So I think you said your wife doesn't like to listen to teachers. She wants to just read the Bible, but she can get that just from the Bible. Does she only read the King James Version?
Yeah, yep, she does.
Yeah. Well, okay.
You're in town, and I'd love to introduce her to you someday, because you say it a lot better than I could ever. Hopefully,
well, I
can get there.
If she's ever willing to, I'd be glad to. Of course, she can listen to the archives of this show on the website. But if you guys just want to meet us sometime, you are in Temecula, so am I. Email me, and we can set up something.
Yeah, you know, I think it'd be helpful. It's definitely good to hear from someone that's been doing it for a long time that can, you know, help in these areas. And I just appreciate your answer there. I'm going to download the podcast and try and memorize it.
Okay. Okay. God bless you, Joel. Thank you for your call. Right. And I certainly wish you well for your family.
Okay. Thank you very much.
Bye now. Okay. Our next caller is Alex from Honolulu. Hi, Alex. Welcome to the Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Hi, Steve. Thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
My question today is, how do you know when something is your something in your life has become an idol, or your relationship with that thing is idolatrous?
Well, one way you can do it is ask God to convict you about it if it is. But there are some rather objective ways. In fact, I actually taught about this in Arizona this last weekend, and the lecture, which is called Keep Yourself from Idols, is on our Facebook page. The video of it is posted at Steve Gregg, The Narrow Path Facebook page. You can get the longer answer there because I did address that. But one thing I would say is you can tell if you are placing something above God by the very practical ways in which you show your priorities. What do you spend your money on? And I don't mean on the groceries and putting a roof over your kids' heads and putting shoes on their feet and things. I'm talking about when you've got the bills paid that you have to pay, and now you've got some extra money. What do you do with it? Well, probably you spend on what you think is worth spending money on. You know, where your treasure is, your heart is. And you can just say, well, what am I spending my money on? And likewise, similarly, what am I spending my free time on? Because time is money, essentially. I mean, it's a commodity that we have. You know, we don't have all of it free, but some of it is free. We do have elective money. We have elective time. And those are a couple of ways you could say, well, what am I spending my time on when I have free time? What am I thinking about when I have free time to think? What am I spending my extra money on? And I often throw this one in too. What is it that I'm hoping for my kids to have? Is it my goal for my children that they be financially successful? Is it my goal for them that they be respectable? That I can boast about my kid, the lawyer, my kid, the senator? Or is it my goal that my children are ready to lay down their lives for Jesus, maybe as missionaries even or something? You know, I mean, basically what you want for your kids is what you value most for yourself in most cases. That is, if you're not some kind of a horrible parent, which I'm sure you're not. So the one way to know if something's an idol is, am I spending, let's say, more of my time, more of my money, more of my thoughts on that hobby or on that thing than I am, devoting to the spreading of the kingdom of God and doing the things that God wants, the things that God values. You know, Jesus said, if you do this, and he talked about feeding the poor and visiting prisoners and things like that. He said, if you do this to the least of these, my brethren, you've done it to me. So the gifts you give to the poor, at least insofar as you're helping poor Christians who are his brethren, this is giving to God. And so I think these are very practical ways in which we all demonstrate what's most important to us. And what's most important to you, if it isn't God himself, may very well be labeled an idol.
So do you think being afraid of losing something, like having a literal fear about it,
that's a worry? You know, that is something that may give you some concern. Maybe this is an idol, but I'm not really sure. To me, I've lost some loved ones, which if I knew the day before I was going to lose them, it would possibly torment me to know it. Not because I idolize them. I mean, when God took them from me, I still followed him, you know. I still remained faithful to him. So, you know, it's not like I said, okay, God, it's going to be you or them. Oh, you took them, so I'm going to not follow you. I mean, if someone gives up on God because they lose something of value to them, then that was certainly an idol. But the mere fear that you may lose it doesn't necessarily identify it as an idol, because you may value things that are worth valuing and not idolize them, you know. And things that you really value, you really, you know, would be loath to lose them. But on the other hand, if Christ is all to you, you would say, it's a terrifying thing to think I might lose this person or this thing that I have. But if I do, I'll consider it a sacrifice to God, because all things that I have are his anyway. I mean, God has to be definitely your whole frame of reference. He's got to fill the whole screen, you know, of your thinking, and not just be one of the items on the list, not even the top item on the list of priorities in your life. He's got to fill your whole perspective on everything. But that doesn't mean that with that being so, that you don't have things you really value or things that you'd very much protect and things that the thought of losing them would be very painful. That's very normal, I think.
Wow. Thank you so much, Steve, for that.
Well, all right,
appreciate
brother.
That answer.
I appreciate your call. God bless you, Alex. I hope you don't lose whatever it is that you're concerned about losing. I've lost some of those things. Carol from Sacramento, California, welcome to The Narrow Path. Thanks for calling.
Thank you, Steve, for taking my call. I was calling about something else, but while I've been on the phone, the Lord kind of put this in my head. I listened to a teaching by Ask Pastor John, and I'm just going to read the verse, and then I'm just going to tell you what I'm relating it to. It's okay. Jesus speaking in chapter 15, and he says, I am the true vine, and my Father is the vine dresser. Every branch in me not bearing fruit, he takes away, and each one bearing fruit, he prunes, so that it may bear more fruit. And the word prune means that it hurts. And this is God the Father doing this. And while I'm responding to this is when the person was talking about his trials, suffering is one thing that God uses for sanctification. And he
certainly
says it. And Jesus Christ himself is saying that God the Father is going to prune you. So when people are shocked, you know, that they're going through trials, Jesus told us that we would and that God would do it. So it's not always people say it's the devil. It's God doing it to making you more like his son.
That's correct.
Okay. But what I'm really calling for was you and I differ on what we believe about the age of the earth. But I would like to know how you explain if Adam and Eve were the ones that brought death on the earth. Dinosaurs are older than 4,000 years, regardless of how old you think the earth is. How do you explain, because they were predators, so how do you explain for the killing that they did if you believe that death came four to 6,000 years ago?
Okay, first of all, you say that dinosaurs were, you know, more than a few thousand years ago. I'm not sure that that's ever been proven, and I'm not sure that we're obligated to believe it, only if we want to be mainstream in the secular thinking about things. But a person can believe that because Christians can believe that the earth is older than a few thousand years. But I think there's a different presupposition there that you're making, and that is when it says that death came into the world through Adam, that this means that animal death did not come in, or that animal did not exist until Adam sinned. I don't think Paul, when he talks about that in Romans chapter 5 or in 1 Corinthians 15, both places he talks about Adam being the one who brought death into the world. I don't think he's referring to animal death. I think he's talking about human death because he's talking about human experience. He's saying that through one man, sin came into the world and death through sin. That is death upon the sinner because all sinned. And in 1 Corinthians 15, he says, you know, in one man, all die. But in the other man, all shall be made alive. He means in the resurrection. And I don't think it's animals he's talking about resurrecting. He's talking about people. Both passages, he's talking about human fates, and he's saying that death came upon the human race because Adam sinned. Now, he's not saying that nothing died, because if Adam ate a piece of fruit, there are cells in that fruit that it would die, you know. And if he accidentally stepped on a bug, I think it would die, even if he never sinned. I don't think sinning was required to bring animal death, because I don't think God ever made animals be immortal. If Adam and Eve had never sinned, I think animals would still die because they're not immortal. So in my opinion, there could be dinosaurs who are carnivores, or let's not even talk about the dinosaurs, let's talk about lions and tigers and bears. Oh my, they're carnivores too. And they existed. I don't think we have to assume that they were strictly herbivorous. I don't think we have to assume that animal death and animal predators preying on other animals is a result of the fall necessarily. Now, some people would disagree with me on that, but I don't think that point can be proven scripturally. I don't think that's what Paul is saying when he talks about death entering through Adam. So if the fact that some dinosaurs were carnivores, as they appear to have been, and they lived before Adam, or you say they did, right? You're saying they did, right?
Yes, but okay. Say they didn't. What I'm saying is if there were animals that were predatory, Adam and Eve would have been in danger because these same animals could have killed them.
No, they had authority over all the animals. They had authority over all the animals. They had dominion over them. God gave them dominion over all the animals.
You could have dominion over a lion. It's still going to kill you.
Not before the fall. Not if you haven't sinned. If you're a sinless person and God gave you dominion over the animals, you and I have a different, I guess, mental picture of the nature of the animal world before the fall. And, I can't prove yours wrong and you can't prove mine wrong
because
the Bible doesn't address it. So I guess we simply have different assumptions, I guess, about the nature of the animal world and man and the relation between man and the animals before the fall. And in my opinion, you're welcome to think the way you do, but there's certainly no reason for me not to think the way I do about it either.
No, thank you. I wasn't calling necessarily to refute you. I would have liked to have some clearing in my own mind because I can't come to grips with it because I haven't eaten animals since the 60s. So I come from a long line of that. And when I became a believer, I still didn't eat animals. But I still can't figure out because I do believe that Adam and Eve brought sin. I mean, and I do believe in the Bible. But I can't figure out, since animals are predatory, and you can't tell a lion not to kill you. If it wants to eat, it's going to kill you.
Well, you can't if you're its lord. If you are its lord, you know what? God can tell animals not to
eat. I totally agree.
Not to eat
Daniel. God and Jesus both. But you and I don't have that power.
No, but Adam and Eve did. Adam and Eve were made as God's regents of the earth and given dominion over everything that moved.
So you think once they sinned, then the animals could kill them?
Well, I think once they sinned, yes, Adam and Eve then were capable of dying. I'm not really sure where this is going, okay, this question.
Well, the question is I'm trying to figure out for myself how to figure out the whole thing with the animal world, not the immortality, but when it was created, and how God actually orchestrated the creation. That's what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to prove you wrong.
Okay, sure. Well, I mean, whether you were or not is not a concern of mine. The point is, I just take the Genesis account very literally. And what can be gleaned from a literal account, I take. And what can't be, I guess we have to leave in the area of speculation. I appreciate your call. I want to get one call in, but we only have a minute for it. I'm sorry, Ken. From the Bay Area, can you do it real quick, or do you want to call another day?
Maybe you can pick it up, the rest of it, on another day. But what's been troubling me for a long time is the Good Samaritan story. I have a tremendous compassion for people that I see everywhere out on the street, and I try to give them change or money or whatever, or food or whatever, and my daughter likewise feels the same way. And when you read the Good Samaritan story, we're told how we're supposed to take these people right home with us and, take care of them. And a lot of these people are dangerous. And so I'm just trying to resolve this in my mind.
Sure.
Because
hey, you know, this is important.
These people that you could bring them in your home. So
yeah, brother, this is important. I'm going to have to stop you because I'm sorry to cut you off, but I have no choice. I'm going to have to ask you to call about this tomorrow because it's important enough. That I can't give you a 10-second answer, and I really have less than 30 seconds before I'm off the air here. So if you could call tomorrow, I'd love to talk about that at length because that's a very important question, and I thank you for making it. I apologize. I can't do it justice. You've been listening to The Narrow Path. We are listener-supported. If you'd like to help us out, you can go to our website, thenarrowpath.com, and you can donate there if you want, or you can just take whatever's there for free because that's what's there for, thenarrowpath.com. Let's talk again tomorrow. God bless you.